If there's nothing new under the sun, you know I'm going over. 'Cause there's nothing left to say. If they said it all here yesterday. If there's nothing new under the sun, I'm going over. 'Cause there's nothing left to do. If I ain't got a chance at something new. 'Cause maybe this is a test, a chance to prove I've got the stuff.
Welcome to Invent It Again, Episode 4. I'm Matt Sagan.
And I'm Christian Slack.
Recently, Christian and I were interviewed for a business radio show by our friend Richard Shear, the owner of QP Sport. His company makes chest protectors for athletes and martial artists, and they ship them all over the world. We had a really good conversation and got some great feedback from some of those who tuned in. But perhaps the best part came right after the clock ran out and we sat down for a coffee afterwards. Now, Richard's been working with us for years to try to figure out how to help people do better innovation. Together with the others that you'll meet in some upcoming episodes, we have produced a 5-page proposal, then we made some 3-pagers, then we made a 2-pager, and finally we recently boiled it down to a 60-second video with a message that resonates with everyone who has seen it. One of my son's teachers, he's 9, my son, not his teacher, mentioned our podcast and asked him to tell his classmates about it. As he was telling me the story, I was a little worried at this point that he wouldn't be able to do it. But because of that little video, he said he doesn't want people wasting their money, so he shows them what people did before so they can work on new stuff. Very proud daddy moment there. So it's great to hear Richard boil it down even more. It's the democratization of ideas. Now, hearing him say this gave me pause because it sounded overly simple. But the more we explored it, the clearer it became that this is a great word to describe what's going on here. But as we always must do, let's first agree on a definition. We already live in a democratic political system. We do get to vote for our representatives. Here, Richard is using it more like a parallel to the expression, the democratization of knowledge, which means the collecting and spreading of knowledge amongst the common people. That's part of what we're all about. If we could get everyone to understand the mountain of gold we're sitting on, which we refer to as the global stock of knowledge, then we can really start to fix some fundamental problems. Patents and IP have been a playing field tilted in favor of the wealthy, those who can afford lawyers.
Yes, Matt. And remember, the primary purpose of lodging a patent is to demonstrate or to create evidence for litigation, whether that's to deter copycats by threatening them or to get money out of them through licensing or lawsuits. So a patent really is defined as the granting of a conditional monopoly for the commercial exploitation of the invention. And that's provided by the patent office in different countries in exchange for disclosing the details of the invention. So there's a tremendous amount of noise from this because there's lots of people putting patents in all over the world. And the key requirement here is novelty, which is central to, it is global. So you can't just say it's new in New Zealand or it's new in New Plymouth or any other place in the world. And it's historically been expensive to do that search process. So in the past, people have to go into the patent office, go through a library, consult with patent examiners who are specialists in their particular field, which may be a really narrow area. And that's kind of changed, of course, with the internet. We've now got this accessible body of information, which means two things to us little guys. So number one, we can and should use this global stock of knowledge, using our access to the internet, to construct a solid defense, what we called our freedom to operate before. So if you know what other people have done, and it's what you're wanting to do has been done in the past, you can rely on that information as a defense to infringing anybody's subsequent patent. So if you listen to episode 2, you know that publicly freely available rocks can break even the most expensive scissors. And so what we're going back to saying is, yes, we can now look very quickly and very cheaply for those rocks using this global stock of knowledge. But there's a whole lot of noise out there, and that comes back to that volume of information is significant in that global stock of knowledge. So number two, and this is really important, is rather than saying, I think or I hope that this is novel because of what I know, that we should identify really what isn't novel about our idea so that we can confidently identify any actual novelty. So we can say, this is what everybody's done in the past. This is what people have done in the past, dating back to a long time ago. And these are the steps that they've taken to improve their idea. And this is where we're at now. And so if it's all been done, that's fine. And we can say that so we've got freedom to operate. If you don't find that the things have been done, then really it's only those things that you think are new that are unknowns. You can't definitively say you have freedom to operate because you haven't found those things. So again, with our analogy, we should use rocks on our own scissors, if you like, to knock them down to size. So it's testing our own ideas quickly, cheaply, inexpensively, so that when we want to lodge a patent, if we do want to lodge a patent for our defined novel improvements, we're doing most of the work that's generally expected of the patent lawyer and the examiner, meaning they have a much smaller job, which means it shouldn't cost as much. And the additional thing there is if we're doing our own work and criticising our own things, then even if the patent gets granted, quite often people will find rocks that can undo the patent. So just getting the patent isn't the final straw. It's actually your knowledge is more important than getting the patent. The idea is that your patent should be valid as opposed to it just squeaking through and you thinking it's valid.
Now, you said it doesn't cost as much, the job that's been handed over to the lawyer, the patent lawyer and the examiner. Would we also be able to conclude that it increases your chances of a successfully granted patent? Is that a stretch too far?
Not at all. So what you're doing effectively is carrying out due diligence or your rigor or your research on your own idea. You're not relying on somebody else with a very short time frame and a lot of pressure to pass things through and process things. So if you're going into it knowing all this information and you can present that information in a way that tells your story as to why you're doing what you're doing, is it because it's an improvement of what's gone on before, then effectively you're doing the work that the examiner would like to do but doesn't have the time to do. The reality here is you've got to look at why you're doing it, and the purpose of why you're doing it is to solve a problem and do it in a novel way. The purpose behind the patent, really in the drive and the focus of getting a patent, is a little bit different, because if, like we've said before, if you go to the wanting a pair of scissors and you go to a scissor manufacturer, you're going to get a pair of scissors. And the same thing is if you want to go and get a patent, that the chances are that you will get a patent, and that's
a patent application.
Yes, that's right. And so if you think you're destined for that, then that's where you're going to go, and it's going to cost you money, but you're not necessarily going to get the full picture.
So this is why Richard was using this word democratization in this sense, is that by doing things that are free and cheap, we can increase the number of people who can do this successfully.
Oh, completely. Yes. So the tool, the information's out there. The tools to access that information are out there. And the discipline that's required, is, as we mentioned before, is something that's learned and developed over time. So, yes, it doesn't. If you spend an hour of your time searching the internet, or even a couple of days searching the internet trying to find a real basis for what you're trying to do, then that's going to save you an awful lot of trouble down the track.
And increase your chances of success.
That's right.
So there's another way in which this democratization of ideas applies to what we're trying to do. It is a way of saying that ideas can come from anywhere and that they have equal value at the idea stage, which is a really powerful antidote to the disease of picking winners. Now, there's kind of three ways in which we pick winners. We pick individual early stage ideas to invest in, whether we organize a panel or we have a public vote, or as individual investors, we limit ourselves to using our own gut feel, influenced by slick presentation and track record to operate outside our circle of competence. Or our own subconscious can be the slick presenter. People's perception of their own ability to pick winners outweighs their willingness to do the work of populating their own circle of competence from the global stock of knowledge, because that's the only way you... Well, other than direct experience, that you can increase your circle of competence. And as we learned from Buffett and Munger, reading is a far more comfortable way to do that. You don't have to pee on the electric fence yourself. You can just read about someone who did and not do it. And this is also indicative of a lack of discipline and not having developed good habits, as you said. And another way we do this is we pick a sector to invest in. So, for example, we earmark resources exclusively for something like food tech. This also encourages the wrong behavior, and it's anti-democratic because from the very start, it excludes people with ideas outside that sector. And another way we do this is deciding that only businesses are eligible for investment. Sir Paul Callaghan, for whom the Callaghan Innovation is named, said that ideas can come from anywhere. Come on, people, did he stutter? Why isn't everyone in this country eligible for such funding? I suspect that it must seem hard to filter the noise, but this is really lazy thinking. Firstly, we're really not considering, when we decide to only take ideas from businesses, how cheap and easy validation really is. And secondly, we use setting up a business as a filter, when in fact that is completely backwards. You should not start a business until after you've validated the idea. So this really can be summed up by saying that we filter out so many good sources of ideas, and then we fear scarcity in this sort of self-perpetuating cycle.
And at whatever level it happens, this has a snowball effect. So from the moment a winner is picked, so whether you're picking the winner or whether you've got a group of people who've just met picking a winner, or you've got an investor picking a winner, it appears to legitimize it. So from the outside, people say, oh, this person said this is a great idea. He's got a document that he's put together that shows it's a great idea. This person's put money in. This other person has joined in and thinks it's a good idea. Then everything focuses on legitimizing it. And so we have things like, you know, this idea was the winner of the Idea Summit, or it's received investment and been backed by Callaghan Innovation, or from a sector perspective, it's eligible for specific, say, food tech funding. And it's taken to mean that it must be a real opportunity because these other parties have provided their own gut feel, if you like, their own perspective on it. But actually, it generates bubbles, because what happens is that once it becomes accepted that this is a good idea and there's no testing, if you like, there's no rigor applied to it, then it takes on a life of its own and it becomes very difficult to change tack, and it becomes invested. There's investment burdens, there's time, there's money, there's people's lives. And it generates these bubbles, and generally these fail to make a commercial return. So we used to, at the very least, require an ideator or an ideas person to put their own skin in the game. But now it's a bit like a drug dealer. So those people are saying, here, we can have some now and you can pay me later. In this way, our best and brightest are saddled with debt, harming, if not ruining, the economics of the opportunity by saddling it with a lot of unrecoverable investment, as well as tying up the precious human resource when they could be working on the right things.
We also probably... you've just used the drug dealer analogy. Would you just share with us the new word that you learned that relates to some of this? And we won't go into it too much, but what was that? What did we call it?
Well, it's a word that I've come across in other areas, but it's also, I think, more widely applied in the investment space, and certainly the Urban Dictionary brings it up like that. And the word is hopium. And so it gives this impression of people sitting around a campfire. And I've seen this, and this is an actual scenario with a startup company that I was looked at about 12 years ago. And somebody comes up with an idea. There's maybe other sorts of drugs involved in terms of alcohol and excitement. And somebody came up with a startup idea, and a few, you know, professionals around there, not professionals in this particular field, but professional people. And they all decided to put money into the pot. So they were smoking the hopium pipe that came from the original ideas person.
We've really got to come back to that, because that's fantastic. It really helps us understand so many things about where the startup community gets it wrong and where the culture gets it wrong. So you reminded me recently of a good saying: efficiency versus effectiveness, doing things right versus doing the right things. How does that apply here, Christian?
Well, this is really straightforward. It's a pretty bland economic process, but there's something
important, fundamental,
completely fundamental. So this goes back to, there's a graph that's used by economists. So it's not the supply and demand; it's the other one. It's the S curve, and what this shows is the progress of cash flow or returns versus effort. And if you look at a startup, the curve starts at a point that's pre-revenue, and so it starts a certain amount of money is put in, seed funding, and the revenue is negative until it either flatlines and dies, which in terms of our statistics is 299 out of the 300 of the patented ideas don't actually make it to become a successfully marketed product. So it can't become efficient, or it begins to rise as the business picks up steam. So the what everyone's looking for is the rise. Maybe this is where the hopium comes in. Is the hockey stick the rise in the returns as you're putting effort in. So as you go from entering the market, you recover your investment, which is the sort of coming off the bottom of the S curve, and then you get an upward profile, and hopefully you want to make that upward profile as long and as durable as you can, because when it gets to the very end of the S curve, it's what's called diminishing returns, which means that you're putting in a lot of effort but you're getting less returns, and that's when things sort of wither and die and people get onto new technology. So where does this all work? So the efficiency is about doing things right. So it's doing things efficiently. So if I'm manufacturing something, if I can cut all the costs out, then that's becoming more efficient. In order to be efficient, you need to have a product in the market and working with that. The effectiveness is about doing the right thing. So it's choosing the right thing. And that comes back to the statistic about 1 in 300. If you're not choosing the 1 in 300, then your decision-making is not effective. And so what you're looking to do there, and coming back to our principles, is to analyze those 300 ideas and, if you like, make that area under the S-curve for the things that don't go forwards, and even the things that do go forwards, as small as possible, so that your investment burden that you've got to recover in the market is as small as it can possibly be, which means you need to spend as little as you can in terms of time, resource, and manpower to get to the point that you can enter the market and it be successful. And that's where our approach comes into play, because what we're talking about are things that are fast, easy, and cheap to test, which will then give you your decision process to move past that into the market and into revenue.
And there's nothing faster and easier and cheaper than sitting on your internet connection and doing paper research first. And that's what the process is
completely.
All about.
And as Buffett says, you know, it's about reading, and it's much better to read about and learn from other people's mistakes than it is to do it yourself. Yeah, exactly.
I've also thought of another way that democratization applies as we're going through this, and it's about flattening hierarchies. I mean, that, getting kind of back to the political system of democratization. So it's, in a sense, it's sort of moving away from a monarchy or dictatorship, sort of authoritarian structures. Why is this a good thing? Well, in the same way that power corrupts in government, it does the same in other organizations like businesses. But even more basically, we really put too much responsibility on the leader and too much faith in their ability to pick winners when we don't democratize. We fund businesses to do startup stuff, but hierarchies aren't a good idea in the ideation phase, because too often we promote people into these leadership positions for the wrong reasons. Often we do this because they are bossy. It's funny that we've actually got a word with this meaning, that it means that to have the confidence to tell others what to do. Instead, we should really be promoting those who are best at staying in their circle of competence while growing it through never-ending reading and in consultation with others who read endlessly. Hierarchies tend not to democratize ideas. For example, in a company, the boss or the panel, management, or the board, they make the plans and the workers carry out the plans. In fact, it is far more effective to use all the eyes and brains in the company to participate, because ideas are a numbers game, not a golden shot.
That's a great point, Matt. And I think the other thing that we really need to look at there is that if you're in an operating business and you're doing these things, then you're typically driven, going back to the S-curve, by efficiency. So it's doing things right. And it's the ideation phase and the development and the decision-making phase that is not about efficiency, it's about effectiveness. And so the two separate sort of skill sets. So you might have a company that's very, very focused and conservative, and long-established businesses tend to be very, very efficient because they've lived through a time of diminishing returns. They might have offshored manufacturing and all these sorts of things to take costs out of a business, but you get very tied into doing things in a particular way. The more efficient you become, the less
flexible
flexibility there tends to come with that. And the ideas phase of it needs to be open and a much more flexible process and much more dynamic, and tends to be that people with the skills of driving efficiency are not the people with the skills of driving effectiveness. But the same people in businesses are making decisions based on their own values. So typically people will look at it more from an efficiency perspective rather than the effectiveness.
So in a corporate environment, we could say that we're using the wrong metrics to decide who's going into the leadership. We're looking at how efficient they are rather than how effective they are at assessing ideas and picking and finding opportunities, real opportunities.
Yes, I think that the other problem is the metrics, as you talk about there, is that typically in a larger organization, the metrics are based around, again, coming back to those things we talked about before, it's about how much is being spent. So somebody might have a research program and it's worth $10 million a year. And so typically that's allocated, or the value that's allocated, that the metric that's given is, oh, we've been really busy, we've spent $10 million this year on this thing. And it might say, you know, we got funding from a funding body, and that means that we're able to spend twice as much. Unfortunately, the relationship between how much you spend and the economic outcomes are completely unrelated.
Which is why we've kind of picked on this 2% GDP metric as being the top, you know, this is the top, or I'll flip it over, this is the foundation upon which New Zealand's current government plan is built, which get to let's spend 2% of our GDP on innovation, and that's gonna get us there.
That's right.
It's not.
That's right. And other metrics as well, that could be the number of patents that have been applied for,
right.
and we know that that's not necessarily a good measure of anything.
Prizes for activity. The greatest ones at this said there are no prizes for activity. In fact, it's only about knowing when to act.
That's right. And equally conferences and all these sorts of things as well. So it tends to be, if you've got you might have an R&D department, and this comes back to the point that you made, it should be the entire business. People talk about open innovation. So there are various corporations that approach things from the perspective that, yes, we employ a lot of people, but there are still really good ideas that come from outside the business, and they operate this open innovation process. And some people do it better than others. And then there are others that go, say, we're going to do everything in-house. So it's got to be invented here perspective as well. So looking at those things as well, the way that people judge things is not based on how many ideas they've looked at and how many they processed, which is what it should be. It's based on how much they've chosen to spend on the thing that was decided on by somebody who most likely took that decision outside their circle of competence. I think we talked before about, if you look back at what Buffett talks about, then the stuff that's inside the circle of competence are the things that are already there to be known and knowable, i.e. they're not new. If you start thinking that you're doing something new, it's automatically outside your circle of competence. And if you're going to an investor saying, I've got this new thing, and the investor's saying, oh, this looks really exciting, we could be smoking on the hopium pipe again, then the investor's operating outside his circle of competence too. So it's a really important...
And the bubble grows.
Yeah, and it's a really important thing, going back to the point we made earlier, that we know what's gone on in the past so we can define what isn't new. Because that gives you a certain viewpoint on the strategy and the way in which you then take that idea forwards.
Now, this doesn't just happen in private companies, does it?
No, not at all, no. So one of the things we've got here is we've got a local government council, and they've been pushing something called Zero Waste.
Oh, the Zero Waste Initiative.
Initiative, yeah.
As part of our larger 2050 city plan or
that's
regional
right. And
plan.
I think they might have introduced some dates that are a bit earlier than 2050 as well, yeah, as an intention. There have been some changes. There's been some structural issues in terms of we've got a landfill, got a recycling capability, recycling centre, and the landfill that's close to the town, which has been landfill there for quite a number of years, has become full. And so we're trucking our non-recyclable waste out to another region, and it's got travelling by road, so there's lots of implications around waste miles. So it was recently announced that the local government, the council, says that we're stockpiling at the recycling centre in our town a whole lot of plastics of different recyclability. So they're saying that we can only recycle certain grades or certain types of plastic. So those are those things when you turn over your plastic packaging or the like, you'll see there are numbers in a triangle. And the reason why they're saying this is that in the past they've taken all the recycling and then they've recycled or repurposed some locally, and they've also sent some plastic to China and other places. And so they've announced that they're going to start putting into landfill a whole lot of the recycling that people have studiously put out, and they've also separated out from the other landfill material. They're saying that the problem is China is not taking our plastic anymore, and the council is saying we can't process this stuff. So things that they've posted offshore in the past, they now aren't able to do, and they're saying they can't process it here. So a bit of a challenge here. We're looking at, you know, why don't they work within their circle of competence, i.e. define the problem, for all of us to look at and listen to those ideas before making decisions. And why do they just say, it's too hard, we can't do it, well, so therefore we're going to put all this stuff into landfill. And instead of sort of honestly and rather humbly following a proven process to find out how other people might have solved these problems and these sorts of things.
We encourage lookers to define problems very clearly and when you're defining those problems, it's also good to know how far upstream that problem is. In other words, some problems are the result of other fundamental problems that we're not dealing with. And in this case, consumer behavior, the packaging is coming from somewhere and we're buying it. So it's really, you know, illustrative of the same problem to hear a new counselor say something like, it's ridiculous to think that consumers can put pressure on a supermarket by changing their buying habits. Says who? I mean, why is it more ridiculous to deal with the problem further upstream? Are there other ways that other countries have dealt with this that have had impact? I would be very surprised if that's not the case. I've seen markets spring up that are package-free, where things are more in bins. You bring your own containers for everything from soap to foods. Why is it ridiculous to talk about that?
I think, again, Matt, with that. Putting a blanket over all this is also saying, well, are those people making those decisions and those comments, are they operating within their circle of competence? And are they talking from a factual basis, or is it a second-hand, third-hand, fourth-hand maybe basis as well?
But we know the answer, because if by definition we have seen other solutions elsewhere in the news or in our travels, so it's not ridiculous because it has been done.
Exactly. And also, there's two sides to this problem, really. One is saying, is it ridiculous to change people's habits and not use these plastics? But equally, you've got to say, well, what was China or these other countries doing with this stuff?
Magic?
that couldn't actually be done here. I mean, there may be lots of explanations. There may be a scale thing. There may be all sorts of other things. But it still needs to be addressed that the problem isn't China's not taking our rubbish anymore or are difficult to recycle plastics. It should be, well, what was China doing to them and what was it transforming them into? And even if
just to clarify, that was one of the arguments against doing something with this plastic, is there's no market for it.
That's right. Right. Yeah. Okay. So I think I've got the article here. It says a 300-ton stockpile of recycled mixed plastics in New Plymouth is destined for landfill at a cost of $30,000 because there is no market for it. And so it's effectively saying we can't sell it off. People aren't paying us the money for it now. If you think about it in terms of processing waste, then there isn't always a market for the waste that we produce. But there is still a social and environmental aspect to reprocessing it to take away any of those risks or negative aspects. So
to give them some points, I've just found another article here about New Plymouth trialing the recyclable plastic in roads. And this is pretty recent. This was June of last year. The equivalent of 83,300 yogurt pots was used in a section of New Plymouth asphalt that I ride my bicycle on just about every day on Liardet Street. It amounts to about 0.5% of the total weight of that section of road, the 500 kilos that they're talking about here. But at least, I mean, this is sort of evidence that there is an application. That's really the right word, isn't it? So at least there's that. But messages coming from council are contradictory.
It would be interesting to know what the market was prior to this. So what the value of this 300-ton stockpile would have been and what the cost. So it's seen as a sunk cost. So it may have been a positive revenue in the past, but what the sunk cost now is $30,000. But comparing that against those other factors.
I think it's important that we draw attention to these things, but ultimately we're just going to keep doing the same things until we understand why we keep repeating these patterns. So why is this the situation that we find ourselves in with both investment and startups and council initiatives and government level decisions?
It comes back to the same principles, Matt, is actually understanding the factual nature of these decisions, if you like. So something gets taken away. Do you sit back and say, well, that's it, I'm not going to do anything, revert to a previous solution, or do we say, you know, is there something else we could be doing with these things? Again, this is a really good S-curve thing, because what you're looking at is something that in the past may have been efficient. So because the market in China is gone, then you can't make it more efficient because it's gone. Okay, and so you need to go back to effectiveness, which means you have to go back to the ideas and understanding the circle of competence to see where that happens. So that's quite hard for particularly for mature companies. So there's a heap of stories from all around the world, but typically as organisations become more efficient, then they become very set in the way that they do things. And that's very hard for them to change the way that they do things overnight. So I think we've mentioned before about looking back at the decision tree, if you like, that people have taken. So back in early 1900s, there were various decisions taken to go with, you know, gasoline-powered or petrol-powered cars rather than electricity.
Right. Even though there were more electric cars on the road than internal combustion engines at that time, which is something that always blows my mind.
Yeah, and obviously the whole support industry that's come with that and around the petroleum industry, distribution and revenues and sales and that sort of thing is all built into that. So if you go back to that and you're in that position now and you say, well, what way are we going to go? Because you've now got knowledge of the history, then you can go back to that and you can, if you're starting out, you could create a company like Tesla, that's going to producing electric vehicles and the technology goes with it. It's very hard for a company like General Motors, for example, who are so indebted in their manufacturing plants and employing lots and lots of people and everything else, to change their entire structure and their entire focus in a short period of time. And that's where things tend to fall over. So there's a very good example, it's quite old now, but NCR, which was National Cash Registers in the States, they always use electromechanical cash registers for forever and ever. And it got towards the late 60s, and a lot of solid-state electronic cash registers were coming on the market. And instead of sitting back and saying, look, this is this revolution coming, and we need to really think about what we're doing and how we, you know, we can deal with this significant change, that they said, no, we're just going to make lots and lots of electromechanical cash registers, and we're going to make them really cheap. And they effectively filled up warehouses full of these things. And then it came the realization that actually people didn't want to buy them. They wanted these lightweight, accurate systems that came with the solid-state electronics. And so their business almost failed overnight because they doubled down on their existing business model, which was efficiency.
Right. After they'd already reached the point of diminishing return, whereas if they'd had the habit of ideating, iterating.
That's right.
It would have been sweet.
And so, coming back to all of these things, going back to the idea stage, it all comes back to the principles about doing things very early on and understanding all of those things and doing things that are fast, easy, and cheap to test. And so with a startup, without being too cynical, then if you've got a startup business, you have all your eggs in one basket. You might have had 10 ideas, but you've taken one of them based on typically a feeling, hope, who knows, the thing that you think is going to get to the biggest outcome in the shortest period of time. But unless you know those things, you're operating outside your circle of competence. So it doesn't matter whether you're a multinational or you're a local government or you're a startup. If you're doing things that you're are new to you, then you can be convinced, again, and like we talked about coming up with ideas, that you have a problem, you come up with an idea, and because it's new to you, it's therefore the best solution to the problem that you have. And that doesn't make any difference between people in any of those environments.
It's the same factor in all of them, isn't it? It's an unwillingness to do your homework.
Yeah, so some of these issues are around, we'll call it laziness, and so it's an unwillingness to do your homework, to really find out what's going on. And it's picking winners. It's easier to take a pack of cards and pick a card and say, this is the one that we're going to go with, than it is to understand the context around each and every one of them and what the process is and who's done what and everything else. So, picking winners is the easiest thing. And unfortunately, outside your circle of competence, the odds of you having a success, the golden shot, the 300-1. The other odds that come with that 300-1 is that actually work that was done some years ago is that it actually takes 3,000 raw ideas. So these are ideas that haven't been qualified and haven't been invested in to get one successful product launch. So 1 in 3,000 is really, really long odds. The chances of it happening are pretty small, and there's an awful lot of steps along the way between not just product launch. This is just a product launch. It doesn't mean that it's a guaranteed thing. So
there's lots of ways to muck it up.
And there are some other odds that reflect this. So same sort of size, the US Patent Office, I think, said in maybe late 90s, that of the patents that were current in the States, so the ones that haven't expired, one in 500 recover the cost of patenting. And that's just recovering the cost of applying for a patent. It's not making a roaring success or a massive return. So, you know, these are really not the kind of bets a sane person would make. And we talked about gambling and the thrill of the chase and the taking a punt, and also people buying lotto tickets. You know, if you know what the odds are, then yes, there's a thrill in putting the money in, and you could be the winner, but the chances of anybody being a winner in their lifetime are minimal.
You got to be in it to win it, though, Christian. You got to be in it to win it.
That's right.
So just on these odds, it really does take good math skills to not only visualize these sorts of odds, but also to even just remember the odds that have been taught to you and to base your behavior on them. I saw a really interesting article recently in the OSU website, news.osu.edu, an article called "Smokers Good at Math Are More Likely to Want to Quit." OSU is the Ohio State website, university website in the U.S. Smokers good at math are more likely to want to quit. People who had better math skills remembered more of the scary numbers about smoking risks that we gave them, and that made a difference. These results may help explain why many studies find that smokers who are more educated are more likely to successfully quit, she said. Oh, this is the scientist behind this study, who I will credit before I get too much further. Her name is Brittany Schutz Reinhardt. Good on you, Brittany. What we saw here is that people who better understood numbers had a better understanding of the risks. We need to find a way to communicate that to people who aren't as numerate. And this is, I think, a mission that we need to now take on for ourselves, because we keep saying these numbers. We've said them, you've said them, especially for years to the same people, and we don't see a huge change in the behavior. So I kind of want to do a little bit of a quick napkin experiment here, a napkin illustration of what's going on. And if we do that with our most important statistic, which is that 1 in 3,000 ideas recovering costs, it's 1 in 3,000, is that 1 yep. in 3,000? Yeah, so that's correct. 1 in 3,000 ideas.
Yeah, it's a I think it's defined as a successful product launch.
A successful product launch. So 1 in 3,000, very long odds to get to that point. So let's do it most do in New Zealand. I can only really talk about what happens here in terms of funding for these early stage ideas. And let's apply for the Getting Started grant, because that's what Callaghan Innovation in New Zealand calls the funding for the stuff at this stage. Because this funding is 40% of the project cost up to $5,000, we're going to spend $12,500 so that we can get as much help as we can. I'm saying this from experience. I've done this very same thing. It's like, how much help can I get? Well, it'd be silly to leave any of that on the table. Let's make sure that we use it up. And so remember, we need to do this 3,000 times to get a good one. And so that's $37.5 million if we're using one of these per each one. But don't forget that this money has to be spent on a limited pool of professionals that are charging, let's say, $100 an hour. So for just one idea, that's 1,250 hours at 35 hours a week. Let's say that there are four people doing this, various aspects of this getting started, doing the research. They just spent 9 weeks, the four of them, with a slim 1 in 3,000 chance that this time is not wasted. And to me, that's not something we can afford to do.
I think the other comment I make there is that in this particular case, Matt, the getting started is for businesses that are not used to undertaking R&D, and this is what qualifies as R&D in this respect. And so the funding for the businesses, and it's a one-off funding round for businesses.
And you can only get it once?
Yep.
In the year? No, I think it's ever, isn't it?
It is ever.
It's ever. That communicates to me that they're already equating an idea with a business, and that's some sort of one-to-one relationship,
That's right. And if you failed, as we're proposing, to fail fast and cheaply, so you failed that idea for 5 hours at $500, then you're then not eligible for the remainder of that funding at all. And so it doesn't support fast failure. It doesn't support ongoing ideation. The funding that is provided doesn't change the odds. And so not only is the individual progressing generally at the odds of 1 in 3,000, that the funding agencies and the investors if they're operating outside their circle of competence, are also investing at that on odds of 3,000 to 1. And the funding for that's provided under these grants that you're talking about is for a one-off. And so you only ever get to use that funding once.
Yes.
Yep. So if you've got 3,000 ideas and you just go with one, you've got all your eggs in one basket. And so the chances are that you're going to go down this road of 3,000 to 1. The other more fundamental aspect is that once a company has one of these grants, it can't have another one. And so if it wants to process further ideas, it has to go through a project grant, which is much larger money. So that these are grants where significant project costs are applied, which doesn't support fast, easy, and cheap testing.
So just talking about fast, easy, and cheap and contrasting it to this $12,500 project, which is sort of the minimum, the getting started. If we contrast that with our fail things faster, and we do it at, let's say, quite a generous $2,000 per.
Yep.
If we do this 3,000 times, we spend $6 million. So that means that we've gotten to our one real opportunity, according to the odds. There might be a couple more, or we might not even have found one yet, but likely we'll find one real opportunity in that 3,000, and we'll have saved $31.5 million.
Yeah, I think there's another factor in there as well, Matt. So we're focusing on these 3,000 to 1 numbers and those odds. The chances are, and the very high, is that we can find alternative ways to commercialize things that already exist. So in terms of this, we can identify if there are products or technologies already available, and that allows us to then leapfrog and succeed faster as well. So the comparison there is very much sticking with the 1 in 3,000, but the reality is that once you have an idea of the circle of competence for a particular idea, that you can then still commercialize it successfully, even if it's not your own idea and you haven't spent a huge amount of time on your R&D, because you're not providing those sunk costs, which may be unrecoverable, and it may be recoverable in a different way in a much faster time frame. So
right.
Not only are we just talking about the numbers, but we're saying that we can redirect these ideas, pivot, if you like, leapfrog, to get the idea into the market and start making revenue, which means that we're getting past that doing the right thing and on into the efficiency, rather than investing in R&D and time prior to getting a return.
When you look at it in terms of solving a problem, it doesn't just have to be getting a product in the market or a service in the market. We could talk about social enterprises in the same way, or we could say that your drive is to save lives. You know, if you're really driven by the problem, then you really have to stop and think why you'd want to spend all that money reinventing the wheel.
Yes.
How about a snap?
Yeah, let's do it, Matt.
So for this snap, we're going to play it a little bit more like we're doing reversos. We're just going to talk about the problem and just do a look around for other ways that this has been solved. So our problem here is that we have waste. We don't want to truck it. We don't want to pay to truck it off to some other town. We want to deal with it and use it here. Obviously, we're aware that it had a market value. China was purchasing it from us and doing something with it. Maybe the scale doesn't fit for what we're doing here. We can't see the economics of it, but that's not a good enough answer for saying we're not going to do anything about it. So let's do a quick snap on what do we do with all this plastic waste. Computer, if you could kick us off.
Okay, Matt, I think the really important thing here is just to sort of couch the problem. And the problem that we've got, I'm just reading from a newspaper article here, is that we've got a 300-ton stockpile of recycled mixed plastics, which is destined for landfill at a cost of $30,000 because there's no market for it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the starting point. And they're calling these hard-to-recycle plastics. And they are the plastics which are numbered 3, 4, 6, and 7. So these are separated at the recycling facility, and they're tied up in a bale, and they're sitting there. They've been outside for a while. Numbers 3, 4, 6, and 7 include biscuit trays, some sauce bottles, yogurt packaging, and sliced meat trays. But there could be all sorts of other things in there too.
Okay.
So we're talking really about those thermoplastic resins. So they've got common types of thermoplastic resins here. They've got polyamide, which is polyamide nylon, polybutylene tetraphthalate, polyethylene tetraphthalate, which is polyester, which is used in drink bottles, polycarbonates, polyethylene, so that's low density and high density, polypropylene and polyvinyl chloride. So they talk about those ones. So if they run through each of these individually, you've got number one is polyethylene tetraphthalate, which is mostly the drinks bottles, and tells you about what is traditionally made there. And it talks about products made with recycled content. So they've got new containers, so new bottles, strapping, carpet fibers, clothing, and cushion or jacket filling, so insulation.
There's a great app about making recipes. This is going to sound sideways, about making recipes where you walk up to your pantry and you just list, you enter what you've got in your pantry and it gives you a recipe to cook.
Yep.
What we're doing here is you're looking at all the inputs, you're looking at the raw materials, what have we got here? When we say plastics, we say waste plastics. You're listing the ingredients and now we're going to go and find a recipe to cook with this stuff, essentially. Yep. Is that a good way of summarizing this for our listeners?
Yeah, and it's important to remember as well is that all of these recyclables at the moment go into your recycling bin, mm-hmm. 1 to 7, and then at the recycling centre, the ones that are relatively easy to recycle are split off, and the others have previously been sent to China, but now they're being bailed up to store. So
yep.
There's another point around that, which is, you know, are people confident enough to split their numbers, if you like, or their waste plastics, mm-hmm. recyclable plastics, into those numbers at home, which would save the recycling centre an awful lot of time and effort in terms of sorting them on site.
Right.
As far as I know, it's a fairly manual process. So if we look at the newspaper article again, so they're saying that they would, in the future, may soon only recycle plastics numbered 1, 2, and 5. Personal knowledge, I think there are some issues, you know, if you're wanting a particular colour and that sort of thing, then having a mixture of colours is not necessarily the easiest thing to get an outcome that you might want. So those are the first two.
But that's a constraint we can work with. We're looking at things where we don't mind what colour it comes out. If it's beige, it's beige.
Yep.
What can we do with it?
They all have a possible use. They're not impossible to recycle, given this information here.
Right.
There's some physical outcomes that can be made from these materials in recycling them.
Yep.
We know that there is a method. It's not an impossible, it's not a technical issue of using those. It just might take more effort or a more restricted outcome or whatever to do that. So in the previous thing where we looked at the building blocks that was made by compressing waste plastic together, it was relying on the fact that these are thermoplastics,
right.
So when it's applying heat and pressure, and effectively each of the individual scrap bits of plastic, whether they're bottles or whatever, softening, and they're being compressed together to make a building block, which can then be coated with rendered plaster or whatever. So,
or not. I mean, it could just be an outdoor shed and it could just have a life. And
So we've already got a possible outcome for this.
Yeah.
And I think it's just important that we probably try and look at other ways. So the biggest question here is, well, what did or what does China do with these plastics that it no mm-hmm. longer wants?
Right.
And is it an economic decision that they've taken, or were they storing it somewhere in a hole in China? And it got full.
We're not taking any more of that.
Exactly. So it's just trying to look at how this problem has been solved elsewhere. And again, coming back to it, you've also got this problem that councils are talking about. This is how you separate these materials out at the point that you put them in the recycle bin, rather than using their staff to take these things out and send them to landfill. So is it our responsibility to put it into the landfill container at the house, or is it their responsibility to decide what to do with those streams that they have in their possession?
We probably don't have the scope right now to do this in a quick snap, but there are all kinds of business processes that we could come up with: volunteerism, paid jobs, additional jobs, creating work, doing the separation, if we can make the economics stack up.
Yep, without a doubt. And, you know, if you look around, we'll stick with the building blocks thing. We've covered off the company in Dunedin. But if you look around, there's actually a company in Colombia called Conceptos Plasticos that recycles plastic into disaster-resistant building blocks. So they're effectively turning their plastic waste into granules, and they're forming blocks, effectively like Lego blocks. They're blocks which slot together. And they say here that they built a house in 5 days using recycled plastic brick. In terms of products, I don't think they're separating out any particular product there. They're granulating it first, so they're chopping it up, making it into little pieces. And of course, if they're applying heat to little pieces, a bigger surface area there, more of it will melt than if you were trying to stick two plastic bottles together.
Right.
And so you get a much more coherent product. and it looks to me that they can make these things and that it gives a reasonable surface finish. So there's quite a lot of articles on this. I haven't seen anything particularly from the company itself, but no doubt if we had a look, we'd find them. But the company's called Conceptos Plasticos. Cool. I might have the pronunciation wrong there.
Nope.
But,
that's, sounded pretty good to
and
me.
And they're from Colombia too. So that's an interesting thing. You know, you've got a country that hasn't got a high economic output and it's taking things that are causing trouble, which is waste, and turning them into buildings.
We expected to find this. I mean, this is why that story about that machine that he'd come up with that resembled the peat brick process, why he was doing that in the first place. You know, it's a good idea. It's a good idea to make building blocks out of something else.
Yeah, and you know, they're relatively high-value outputs. So, again, don't know the total cost of producing these things, but they're taking something which is a waste and has a cost to dispose of, and they're turning it into an artifact that has value.
Yes. Are you going to follow this lead? Keep going. Are you going to keep following this lead in terms of bricks and building? Is that seem to be some of the most exciting? I mean, we also saw that article about the roads. You know, having some plastic content in roads. Yep. I'm just kind of looking at, right now at recovering oil from these obviously plastics are coming from oil, and there are ways of reclaiming oil. Again, is it worth looking at the economics of that?
Yeah, sure. And so there's quite a lot of technologies around that use a process called pyrolysis,
yes,
which is breaking down material into its constituent parts. So that's been developed for a long, long time and has applications in a whole lot of things, but in particular another problem of recycling, which is actually taking vehicle tyres and recovering the steel belts, recovering oil constituents, and recovering carbon black from the rubber as well. And it's technically feasible, and it's been done many, many times. The economics are such that to be economically viable requires quite a lot of heat and things that some of these other things don't. But you do get this sort of fractions of materials that you can take out of the process. So the scale of it needs to be quite large. So there's a plant in the UK that covers the whole of UK and elsewhere that just does pyrolysis of these things, and that works economically as well as environmentally. And I think we've got to look at the costs as well. We've got to look at the environment costs in exactly the same way as the cost of what we're trying to do.
So can't ignore it.
There's another here, Popular Mechanics, always a good place to look as well. And this is an article from last year, 2019. This says, this house is made from 600,000 recycled plastic water bottles. Now, I know that the plastic water bottles aren't necessarily in the stream that we're talking about.
Yep.
But it says here, Canadian builders have built a home out of more than 600,000 plastic water bottles. A company called JD Composites built a 3-bedroom home alongside the river in Nova Scotia, but you'd never guess it from looking at the home. There's some photos on here on Popular Mechanics. So if you Google JD Composites and Popular Mechanics, that's probably the best place to go to. It looks really high-end. So they're taking something out and using it as well. So there's the whole lot of things that are worthy of investigation. Anyway, going back to our Warren Buffett comments, it's worthwhile people doing some reading before they make their decisions about these things.
And we're not inside the council. We don't know the exact process that they're going through, and we're not pretending to know that at the moment. We're just trying to kind of illustrate that what we see in the plans that come out in the news and in their quotes is not sort of indicative of the attitude that we're trying to do here. We're very quickly just looking through what's there just to show how much gold is out there, how many ideas and how many ways of dealing with things there are out there, and we should know about them.
Yeah, and I think that's right, Matt. So we're looking at that decision process, and like you say, we're not privy to a lot of information. We're just reading what we've seen in the newspaper. But it's really important for someone, and we're promoting this as part of our process, it's really important for people to say, how have other people solved this problem? And that's not really clear from what we're saying, that there's no one saying, oh, there's an alternative here, it's going to cost money, or we're going to have to create some specific piece of plant or equipment, or borrow something from somewhere, or trial it, or whatever.
Or even telling us what's happening with the plastic that we're paying to ship to some other town. What are they doing there?
Yeah.
You know,
I think it's going to landfill. I think that's the thing. So they've got these...
So are the councils? Are there several councils working together to look at that landfill to go, okay, well, if we pooled our resources, you know, maybe it's actually not a bad idea to send ours to this central location if we get this much value out of it and have this much less environmental impact. Was it just, before I forget also, because we're in the snap mode and we're supposed to be looking laterally, you also mentioned car panels. There was a car that was made that utilized waste plastic, recycled waste plastic panels?
From that great commercial center of East Germany, the Trabant, as it was called, had a body made out of duroplast.
So duroplast, yeah.
So that was a mixture of waste from cotton mills and things like that, and fibrous resins. Yeah, so it was like a fiberglass, but it was actually, because it was a good example of thermoplastic, is that the fiberglass is something you mold and then you add an activation agent
and it goes off resinous kind of stuff.
Yeah, so it goes off and goes hard.
Yes.
And no matter if you heat it up, it doesn't melt because everything's cross-linked and it'll char or set, you know, it might set on fire a bit because you're going to have a bit of solvent and things in there, but effectively it's not possible to reshape it.
Glass, part of fiberglass.
That's right. And so the difference in that is that the duroplast is actually a thermoplastic, so like we're talking about here, which goes soft, so the way it's processed, without going into huge details, when it was manufactured, it was compressed like a stamped out, if you had a steel panel or something like that.
Yeah.
It was compressed and formed in situ, so rather than it being laid up and gone hard and then taken out. So it could be made quite quickly, but it was also using machinery that was
repurposing it.
Yep. Yeah. And so, you know, everyone laughs and says, these cars are made out of paper or cotton or black bits of, you know, dustbins and all the rest of it. But ultimately, it was a, you know, they were doing what they could with what they had, which is their resource. And again, that's coming back to our New Zealand number 8 fire, all those things, that these are, yes, it's waste, but for somebody's waste, it could be a resource. It's a bit like the Wombles, making good use of the things that we find. You know, if we've got a whole lot of this stuff, then we should be doing something useful with it.
So look how, with just a tiny bit of work, during a podcast, in half hour or less, we were able to discover all these different ways of dealing with this problem of plastic waste. But let's get back to why we're so often unwilling to do this work.
In some ways, it's quite straightforward, Matt. An investor looks at the idea and they're looking at how that's presented. So for them, there is an unjustified cost for scrutiny of the global stock of knowledge, because they know how to make this decision. They pride themselves and telling other people how great they are at making these decisions. So, for example, if they're about to put, say, $15,000 into an idea and they're looking at $2,000 to apply scrutiny to it, they perceive that turning it prior up, which means that it's not such a good idea, turns that search cost into waste. So it's a sunk cost for them, which they don't recover. And so they mistakenly opt not to spend that and instead just take the punt because it's not that much more. So I'm only putting $15,000 in, so if I spend $2,000, I may as well put it all in because my return is going to be, you know, better with $15,000 than it is with $13,000. And they perceive that the money is better spent in development. So this is, again, going past that point of making the right decision to do the right thing and getting into manufacturing and developing things and potentially, and a very high potential of inventing things again. So the mistake here is underestimating the value of the global stock of knowledge and the poor odds. So, you know, they're making a choice, if you like, and maybe it's an unconscious choice to invest at the odds of 3,000 to 1, rather than changing that to numbers which are much, much smaller, and where the cost of failure and the cost of testing, you know, fast, easy, cheap to test, is a means of, from Warren Buffett's perspective, of not investing. So we're back to that scarcity thing again, Matt, where, oh, this is an opportunity, it's coming up, the deal's closing tomorrow, we want your money in the door, and this other person's put money in.
Red
flags all over, rather than saying, I'm taking my time, I need to understand this in full, and then I will make the decision to invest or not. It's running with the herd, and I know we've already stated this, but if it's new to you, and you're convinced that it's new, and the person who's giving the information that it's new, then you are outside your circle of competence. And so when you're outside your circle of competence, you are investing at those odds. And that's a really important thing to remember, is that the fact that you invest twice as much money or anything else is not going to change the odds of that investment coming to fruition. And so acting that way is sort of in violation of principle. It's scattering your money about thinking that one of these things might take off, which is actually a business model that's used by a lot of people. It's a numbers game. If I invest in 10 things, I expect one of those things, no idea which, but I expect one of those things to happen
and that's not successful. That's not democratic because most of us don't have that kind of money sitting around. We really need to be frugal with our resources.
That's right. And so, again, the ideas from anywhere, what we're saying here is a hierarchy. So by the time these opportunities have got to an investor, they've already been through a whole string of processes which further affirm that this idea or this technology or this product is the bee's knees.
And we're not critical of how good we have gotten at those things. It's really good that we're efficient at building businesses and building teams and mentorship. This is something where the startup community tends to shine. It's just the second step. It's not the first step. It's the second step after the rigor. It's not just that investor who's unwilling. The ideator also looks at their idea and they see scrutiny as a source of pain because they fear that not being the first will hurt so badly that they protect their fantasy by hiding from rather than celebrating the achievements of those before them.
In some ways, a lot of them are rather necessarily hiding from other people, but they don't want to know that those people or those products or those things exist. And it comes back to this process of having an idea, and it's based on what I know, and it has to be based on what I know because what I've experienced, and making that jump and that leap of faith from saying, this is my idea, it's new to me, and it's the only way I can perceive of solving this problem, therefore it is new to the whole world and carries value. Again, it's the gut feel. It's the not necessarily doing the reading to justify your unique or your best solution. It's going through that, so you're not utilizing that knowledge to make the right decisions.
And of course, it's critical that we make the right decisions about what to invest in. As ratepayers, we entrust our money to Callahan Innovation, who's in charge of making sure that we fund the right things at the early idea phase in the form of a Getting Started grant. And in order to understand why that grant is set up the way it is, it's probably important to understand why Callahan was created in the first place. Why did we set up Callahan and what's their job? What are they there to do?
Well, Callahan describes itself as New Zealand's innovation agency. And it's there to stimulate and support innovation in New Zealand businesses, looking for commercial outcomes. Obviously, if we go back to our definition of innovation, then we're looking at invention plus exploitation. And you know, those two things are quite different. Quite often you hear people talking about the valley of death between innovation and commercialization, you know, taking things maybe that other people have done and moving them through into a commercial sense. So,
which is an important skill, an important function in an innovation ecosystem, but we're really trying to draw a line between Callahan and what's our other agency that is supposed to be around commercialization? Wouldn't that be NZTE?
We have a separate agency that's around really the market. It's called New Zealand Trade and Enterprise, so it's around the export of goods and services and these sorts of things as well. So it's interesting that there's a bit of an overlap here. Both come under the same ministry, Business, Innovation and Employment, so it's a very large ministry in New Zealand. But they have different focuses. So, for example, talking about intellectual property, the Intellectual Property Office is more associated with the New Zealand Trade and Enterprise under this larger ministry. And Callahan Innovation, although it's described as an innovation agency and it's got innovation in its name, is typically focused on research and development. So it's about encouraging people to spend money. And both agencies and the larger ministry have this aim to increase business expenditure on R&D to 2% of GDP by 2027.
So which we've criticized as the wrong metric, and I think we've justifiably done so.
Completely. And I think that's something that's, if you like, we also talked about the drug dealer and everything else. So if everything's focused on getting people to do something, which is the wrong metric, then
activity,
yeah, than expecting returns to come from doubling things is not going to happen. And there's lots of historical stuff. I think we put something on the website about, there's a guy from MIT Sloan called Michael Schrage, who published an article in the Financial Times in 2005 and saying that, you know, that the fact that expenditure on R&D was falling in Europe shouldn't have everybody thinking the sky was falling in, but that's the way it was reported, because actually the most innovative companies spend less than average on research and development. And that reflects an earlier stuff that says that people who spend the most on an R&D projects generally don't have the most successful products. And there's a lot of psychology in that. People will become attached to things, and they have what people call the walking dead projects which can't die. People can't think of killing them off. And we looked at the Dyson one, or we talked about the Dyson one with his electric vehicles, where he'd spent £500 million deciding not to go ahead.
Another way of expressing those is the sunk cost fallacy, right? That's what that is. So,
that's right.
So when we're trying to apply this to looking at this getting started grant and potentially trying to, you know, we don't want to just criticize, we want to offer some solutions. And so I think trying to draw a bit of a line between what Callahan does and what NZTE does, when we look at our definition, the clearest definition of innovation, including exploitation, would it make more sense if Callahan was just called the R&D agency instead of the innovation agency, and we're a bit clearer about the definition and about the lines between? And I'm going to just take this one step further. What if the R&D funding from Callahan was 100%? They came up with the right priced thing for doing the earliest stage testing. This getting started really became the should I get started grant, or how do I get started on solving this problem? And that was 100%. But instead of it being black and white, as we're kind of worried with seeing the R&D tax credit legislation, where once you start, if you discover it's not new, you've wasted it all. But instead it was sort of on a scale whereby after the process we were championing about rigor is undertaken, you either get something like half commercialization funding through NZTE, thereby rewarding those that have done their homework and also funding things from the right place, from the right budget. Basically shrink Callahan funding and expand NZTE funding and get more successful businesses and less waste. Does that sound reasonable, or am I just...
I think there's definitely a rationale there. I think the issue becomes, we've talked a lot about the principles and this fast, easy, cheap to test. And what we really need to understand is that while that can be described as R&D, and we talk about literature searching and searching the global stock of knowledge for information, the R&D that is supported through the tax credit and through Callahan Innovation is R&D within the business. So these tend to be longer term R&D projects, so we're committing to large numbers. And the issue is that our principle, or one of the principles, is that in order to get sufficient ideas processed on a per project level or per idea level, we should be spending as little as we can on R&D and time and resource to get to the point that we need to get to, which is the leapfrogging thing. If we know what everybody else has done and we need to focus on one part of that, 10% of the idea or 5%, then that's where the R&D should go if it's required at all. And so there are an awful lot of projects that don't require any, if you like, of this R&D.
Straight to the exploitation.
That is funded. Yeah. And it's not. And by forcing people to spend time and effort doing that, you're actually delaying their time to market and you're delaying their understanding of the global stock of knowledge. So really, the funding for doing R&D, in my view, should be shrunk. The funding for doing lots of ideas instead of just the one at the moment should be expanded, so that we're funding people to go through understanding the global stock of knowledge. And there should also be more funding at, once you've established the global stock of knowledge, at then getting that product out there or the service or whatever out into the marketplace, so earning revenue. And so really the focus on R&D should really be turned on its head. The important thing here to remember is also what Callahan won't fund. So when you're doing your work, Callahan Innovation won't fund market research, right?
Why not?
And I mean, well, the thing there is that's the job of NZTE, and they presume that the way you do this is to go have an idea and then you do your R&D and check it out and see whether it works or not. then you try and understand the market. But the market has such an influence. And when you actually think about the global stock of knowledge, the global stock of knowledge includes all that market information, all the technical information, all the disclosures about people's successes and failures in the past.
And even on a completely novel thing, it's still cart before horse stuff, because if you can determine on a napkin or by asking a few people in the market or looking at the market that what you're pursuing, there's nothing in it, then you could have avoided all this cost, all this waste.
Completely, yes. The fact that something works doesn't mean that people are going to buy it or it's going to be competitive. And I think we've talked about, you know, crushing or cutting walnuts with a laser.
Yeah, I was just going to bring this up. So we're writing a charter, and we're going to be talking about this a little bit more, and we're going to open source this. We really want feedback. We want input onto this Invented Again charter. And there are several gates, four gates at the moment. And in gate three, we will describe the idea, the solution to the problem, and assess its cost. So this is a great example. I could use a laser to open a walnut, and maybe nobody's ever done that before, but it would not pass this gate, because in any case, it just is not a cost-effective solution. The average person is not going to want a laser to crack that walnut.
Yeah, and in any case, even if it does work as well, Matt, is there, if you're doing it in the order that we're talking about, having the idea and then doing the R&D and then testing the market, then you've got a situation there where you're carrying out your R&D on something nevertheless, you know, in any case. So whether it's it's likely to be successful or not commercializable, you're not irrelevant. Taking that into account at the time that you're doing your R&D.
So, which is the wrong approach. So let's just get back to what you just said. Callahan won't fund market research when in fact that should be one of the first and earliest and cheapest experiments.
Yes. So, and it also reflects, going back to our comment about the S-curve, Matt, is that if you look at the S-curve, NZT and E would generally be applying their input after the point at which these things have started in the market and are earning revenue. So that's the 1 in 3,000 things that NZT will be focusing on.
Yep.
And so in the left-hand side there, if you're not including the market research, which is all manner of things, then you're going to be stuck in that left-hand side for a lot, lot longer.
Yes.
And by promoting R&D expenditure 2% of GDP, then you're forcing money into these ideas without that information. So if you like, the very funding mechanism is operating outside the circle of competence as well.
We've got to change this.
Yep.
With so much talk and emphasis on startup culture and the traits of a successful startup, I think it's clear that we're missing the mark in some ways. We're doing a lot of good stuff around the education of the right attitude of building a business once you've identified, well, I won't say once you've identified, because we're not necessarily always rigorously going through that process, but we're really, I think we're seeing a lot of enthusiastic and energetic young people really excited about entrepreneurship, and we're giving them really good events, we're giving them really good material and support and mentorship. And there's some really great, especially here in Taranaki, there's some people who are really dedicated to this. But I'm really glad that we're taking a moment to put the cart behind the horse, put the process in the right order, and to just remind ourselves and everyone else that it doesn't matter how good you are at building a business if you're not building the right business.
Completely. And I also think, without jumping too far back, that the focus on things being totally new and the focus on invention is unhelpful.
Mm.
And we've only got to look at some of the larger organisations that have appeared in the last decade or so. Companies like, for example, Uber and these things, which are entirely based on business model innovation, if you like. People have been driving cars and carrying people for a long time, and horse and carts and stagecoaches and all sorts of other things. And this idea and the platform that they've created is not unique in terms of a physical uniqueness, but is different in terms of the platform, their ability to network and to use these things to create revenue and not have massive amounts of real estate or physical ownership overhead. So the reality is that creating a different business model and innovating, i.e. exploiting existing things differently, is a really important focus. So it's not about getting tied up with whether your piece of code is totally new or anything else. And it's even more important that people understand what other people have done and don't assume that they've got something that nobody's ever thought of before.
So those are two principles you've just covered. Don't obsess about being the first and celebrate the finding of the rocks instead of fearing that.
That's right. And then it comes back to that R&D funding as well, because what is it you're developing? You're developing a platform and software and business structures and payment systems and all these sorts of things, quite often which aren't new. So these are things that are straightforward to implement. And so the risk goes from not in the invention risk as such, it's actually in the implementation or the integration of these different components that already exist and get into market. So that speed to market and the way that the market expansion of these things is very different from the typically older model, but still model of developing new technology and a new product and then taking that to market. It's a very different process, and the focus needs to be different as well. So in terms of the startup things, there are many more ideas potentially, or maybe less restrictions on things that are exploiting other people's technology or existing technologies is much more productive and a lot less risky than this totally new idea that I need to have in order for it to gain investment and gain traction.
Let's stand on the shoulders of giants.
Yep.
And let's spend those limited resources that we have on creating real value, lasting value, sustainable value, and not just bubbles.
Yep.
I want to thank you for listening, and I want to thank Christian for his time and his words.
Thanks too, Matt. It's great that we've got to the end of episode 4, and may there be many more.
If I have my way, there will be. We'll see you next time.
See ya.